sixth case of the day, United States v. Rand.
Good point.
Mr. Morris.
May it please the Court. My name is Gareth Morris. I represent James Rand, who has been sentenced under Section 1512A1. It's his contention that it is an unconstitutional application of this statute to him because the statute clearly, both in its specific language and in its use in every reported decision, would not encompass the conduct that he did, what he did.
Suppose Khaledi's plan was as follows. He would kidnap White, lure the pretrial services officer to his house, and when the officer arrived, he would aim a gun at White's head and say, if you turn off my bracelet, I'm going to kill this man. Would that fall within the statute?
I think not. I'll use a parallel analogy that is in the brief, which is a robber walks into a bank and says to the teller, hands a note and says, if you call the police, you will suffer great harm, or I'll hurt you, or I'll get you, or something. There is no 1512 violation there because there is no prior offense. The critical distinction between the case involving Rand and your hypothetical and the bank teller hypothetical, there's no prior case as to which a witness is being tampered with. There's no victim who's being told, you better not show up. The very purpose of this statute, and it's written right into the law, the purpose isn't ambiguous here. Congress said, and it's in the appendix at page 14, Congress declares the purpose of this act to enhance and protect the necessary role of crime victims and witnesses in the criminal justice process. Not only in your hypothetical, there is no prior crime. There cannot be tampering unless there's a prior crime. And that's a critical distinction. I've surveyed every case that's ever been. There's always a prior offense, and then there's an effort by the defendant who's being prosecuted under 1512 to stop that information getting into the official proceeding, a word that's used 22 times in this statute. There's always that effort to inhibit by killing, by using physical force or harassment, and so on.
Now, were there any parallel state proceedings for aiding and abetting murder?
No, there were not.
No.
The government chose to try to squeeze this classic local murder offense. Sorry. The statute itself makes it clear that there must be a prior offense. Subsection J relates to the penalty, and it says that if the offense under this section occurs in connection with the trial of a criminal case, the maximum term of imprisonment which may be imposed for the offense shall be the higher of that otherwise provided by law, meaning under 1512, or the maximum term that could have been imposed for any offense charged in such case, referring back to the previous criminal case. So the classic case is of witness tampering is a drug case, and they say you better not testify, or they kill the witness. And there, the penalty is trumped up from the harassment, for example, only attracts a one-year sentence under here, I believe, 1 or 2 years. But if it involved a drug case where the potential penalty was 30 years or life, then the penalty for witness tampering through harassment is raised up, again, because there's a prior offense. The second reason why Rand could not possibly be charged under this statute is that William White was not a witness, a victim, or an informant. And if you read the statute closely, and I spent an awful lot of time sort of parsing through it, and there's a clear historic distinction between Section 1 and Section 2. Section 1 uses only the word prevent. It says, whoever kills or attempts to kill another person with intent to prevent a communication, the communication, to a law enforcement officer. Whereas Section 2, involving physical force or threats of physical force, prohibits intent to influence, delay, or prevent. Now, in reading a statute, you must give meaning to those words and the distinction. The distinction is, I should add, Section A1 involving killing of a witness was added in 1986. And so it was added after all this other language existed. Congress chose only to use the word prevent and not to use the words influence or delay. And the reason is that when you kill a witness, you're not influencing or delaying them from testifying. You're preventing them. And that's the only possible reason why there's a distinction between A1 involving killing and A2 involving the use of physical force.
If the government were to fail to convict Rand, would double jeopardy or the statute of limitations prevent a state court proceeding for aiding and abetting murder?
I think not. I mean, I'm loath to open the door to a prosecution of my client. He has, by the way, been convicted under count 2. He has not appealed that conviction. He acknowledges that he was, in fact, involved in one of Calladay's various schemes. Calladay had all kinds of strange schemes. He was going to have Nigerians fly into the building, and he was going to burn it down. He was going to get a cadaver. Mr. Rand's connection to this is very remote. He brings White there. It's unclear whether or not he understood what would happen to him or not. We haven't appealed that because there is some evidence, actually right after a polygraph, that he said, well, Calladay once said, if you can't get a cadaver, you just kill somebody, and I didn't take him seriously. So we can't appeal it on that basis if we've chosen not to.
So what was he sentenced to on that count?
Well, Judge Gottschall said that she wanted it back for resentencing if this first count was set aside by this court.
I know.
And the maximum sentence is 5 years. But there is no prohibition. There would be no double jeopardy in prosecuting him for a crime which isn't even a crime in our view. So I don't see how that could in any way protect him from prosecution. This is a local offense. I mean, if Calladay had gone to a convenience store and shot the owner to get money to buy a car to drive off to Boston to violate the terms of his bond, the government's interpretation of the statute would be that's witness tampering. You killed somebody, and it's part of a scheme to violate your bond. The language of Section A1 makes it clear that the killing must be with intent to prevent the communication, and there's a connexus between the act of killing, the person who's killed, and the communication. That doesn't exist here at all. The other issue that we have addressed in the brief is the legislative history. The government cites a lot of legislative history, which mistakenly doesn't apply to Section A1. When the Act was first passed, A1 was the section involving physical force. And there's a lot of discussion about legislative history that relates to that. And, in fact, the Evans case also cited relates to subsection B, which involves intimidation, threats, or corruptly persuading another person, or misleading conduct. Now, this is certainly misleading conduct. Calladay was certainly involved in misleading conduct. But, of course, the government doesn't pick that section because it has a lower sentence. If there are any questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Thank you.
Ms. Moncrief.
May it please the Court. I am now Felicia Mano Alicia, having changed my name recently, so I know that's not reflected on the documents.
I'm sorry, I'll address you correctly. The card shows Moncrief.
And that's fine, too, but the last name is now Alicia, A-L-E-S-I-A.
Okay. And was that a submission?
It's not. I haven't submitted anything. I just recently got married, Your Honor, so I just wanted to inform the Court.
I just didn't think we had the change indicated from the clerk.
I don't believe we do. But on behalf of the government, defense counsel or the appellant just said that the statute is not ambiguous. We could not agree more, which is why there is no need to go into the legislative history or the title of the statute or what anybody thought at any given time. What we look to is the text, and that's what the government's brief focused on. But we said, in the event that we didn't focus on the text, the legislative history supports our position as well. What happened here is Joe Calladay got help from his friend Rand and had him bring White to his house so he could kill him, kill White, to prevent the pretrial services officer from telling the court this guy has messed up on his supervised release.
Excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because I really have a problem with the government's position here. I'll just tell you that. It wasn't Calladay's intent to prevent his pretrial officer from communicating information about a crime. To me, his intent was just the opposite. If all had gone well, the pretrial services officer would have learned that his ankle bracelet alarm had sounded, and upon arriving at the house to investigate it, he would have said, "Oh dear, Joe Calladay is dead. I guess we can't prosecute him now." In other words, his intent was not to prevent communication. His intent was to escape. I mean,
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because if Joe Calladay had been the one to have walked off with the ankle bracelet, that violation would have reported. He wanted to walk off, but without his ankle bracelet. And the only way that he could do that would be to kill somebody else and have somebody else wear the ankle bracelet, thereby preventing the fact that he had left to be communicated to the court.
It seems to me that he didn't kill White with the intent of stopping his pretrial services officer from communicating that Calladay had fled. In fact, his intent was that his pretrial officer would communicate to a judge. And under his plan, the pretrial officer, you know, would have communicated that Calladay had died.
Again, Judge, if the pretrial services officer would have thought that the dead person in the chair was Calladay, there would have been no guilty admissions having to have been made. If White had not been killed and Calladay left with his ankle bracelet, he would have been reported to the judge. His supervision would have most likely been revoked. But by the fact that he killed White, and the plan was for the pretrial services officer to believe that White was in fact Calladay, that would prevent the pretrial services officer from reporting to the judge that Calladay had violated his supervised release.
Look, no one prevented or intended to prevent the pretrial service officer from communicating. Calladay intended to give the pretrial services officer false information, but that's a different crime.
Judge, that's not what was presented at trial, nor what the jury found. The pretrial services officer had testified that if such information had been given to him, that he would have then reported it to the court and law enforcement. Now, appellant in his argument says that the statute does not apply to anybody other than a witness, a victim, or at some point a family member. The language of the statute is clear. It says if you kill another person with the intent to prevent communication by any person. It doesn't say kill any person with the intent to prevent that person from communicating. It leaves it wide open. Additionally, to prevent communication of information relating to the commission or possible commission of a crime. Mr. Moore spent some time on whether or not it had to be a prior crime, and that if you go up to the bank and you say, "Give me your money or else I'm going to report you," what he's ignoring is the intent requirement of 1512, which adds an additional burden upon the government. The commission of that crime is done to rob a bank to get money, not to prevent that person from communicating something to law enforcement or a court. That's the additional requirement, which also feeds into the jury instruction argument. All of the jury instructions in this case inured to the benefit of the defendant. We charged him with a 1512 offense, under which you see the different penalties. And if you prove that it was a murder rather than just a regular killing, a sentence can be life or death. And we picked first-degree murder. That was our biggest burden to prove. That's what we alleged in the indictment. And in order to prove that, in order to get the life sentence for Mr. Rand, we had to prove that. So we also, we not only had to prove that Rand aided and abetted in preventing this communication, but also that he aided and abetted the murder with the same mental state that Mr. Calladay would have had. So Mr. Rand is now complaining that the murder definition was included in the jury instructions, but we had to prove that in order to make it a federal crime.
Just tell me this. Was Calladay's intent to escape?
At which point, Judge? After he killed, yes, he planned to go to
Poland. Well, I mean, that was the whole plan the whole time. He's having planes, you know, coming to...
Right. He planned to kill William White and to leave and to go to Poland, was mentioned right. in the record, or somewhere else in Europe. He planned for that body to be assumed, for everyone to assume that body was his and for him to flee. Now, as I just said, the court had initially
Did
asked...
Did
that
look anything like Calladay? Calladay's like 450 pounds or something.
And I think that
it's
was
hard to find a body double to...
And I think that was part of the problem, because when they went to the morgue after all this had happened, the body there was clearly not 450 pounds.
Well, he was wearing Calladay... Poor Mr. White was wearing Calladay's clothes, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how do clothes for... I mean, didn't like the people that...
I'm assuming they fit rather loosely, Your Honor.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about 240 pounds here.
So, but to get back to your initial question, because I want to explain this the best way that I know how.
Yeah, I have a logic type compartment.
And I'm happy to direct my remarks to that. Mr. Calladay absolutely had to ensure that the court did not find out that he had skipped town. He wanted desperately to prevent a communication to the court that he had violated his supervised release. And he was going to violate. He was going to flee. The only way to prevent that happening was to cause the pretrial services officer and the court to believe he had died. And in order to do that without actually dying himself, he had to kill someone.
The statute requires that the murderer kill another person with the intent to prevent the communication of information to a judge or law enforcement officer.
Yes, Your Honor.
Calladay's intent was that the law enforcement officer would tell a judge, he's dead, poor Joe, he's dead.
Calladay's concern was that the pretrial services officer would tell the court he has fled. He wanted to prevent the violation being reported, which is why he had to kill somebody so that communication would not have been passed along. Okay. If there are no further questions, we would rest on our briefs and ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Section B specifically deals with misleading conduct. That's what Calladay presumably was trying to do. There's no evidence in the record of what Calladay's intentions were. I mean, there are some derivative ones from his brother and that he had all these various schemes. But and secondly, the language about possible commission, the case law is just clear that that's got nothing to do with a planned or future commission of a crime. It has to do with the nature of the offense that the witness knows about and whether or not it's a federal offense. And there's a lot of cases, and I've cited them on that. That's simply not what the statute says, that you can be concealing a crime that you're going to do tomorrow, which, of course, Calladay didn't leave till the next day. He walks out of the door the next day. Someone picks him up in a car, and he's still got the ankle bracelet on. So searching in this record for rational behavior by him is problematic. The instructions do harm Rand immensely because they are so confused. They mention a statute that should never have been referenced at all. Section 1111 defines murder, but the jury wasn't required to have the definition of murder. They may have had to make some findings about what kind of an offense this was, but and more importantly, the government concedes that the jury was instructed as to whether to find whether or not Rand had the necessary malice aforethought. And that's simply not the issue. The issue was whether Calladay had committed a murder. In fact, the whole thing's irrelevant because first or second degree murder attracts the same penalty under this statute.
The instructions are troubling, Ms. Morris, but if anything, they seem to burden the government with a greater effort than lesser effort, right?
I agree. They raised the bar, but they also created a lot of confusion for the jury, and they made no specific findings as to what Calladay did. It's clear that all he wanted to do was mislead, and they could have easily prosecuted under that section, and I think that they would have had a valid claim, but not under Section A1. It's just would be an unprecedented extension of the statute. It's a denial of due process. Most importantly, what's always happened here is the government retroactively takes these facts and says, well, let's see if we can fit these into the statute. That's not the constitutional question. The question is, beforehand, reading this statute, could a reasonable person have concluded that being involved in bringing White over there was going to expose them to prosecution for life, imprisonment, or the death penalty, which the government was actually seeking at the beginning of this case?
All right.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. Mr. Morris, you have an additional thanks to the court for ably accepting the appointment and ably representing the defendant.
Thank you very much. I also had the pleasure of working with Mr. Bob Clark in the trial of this matter, too.
All right. He has our thanks, too. Thank you. Court stands in recess. Case is taken under advisement.